Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. This is L.A. Steele. Tonight we're going to discuss the works of George Santana, who was a great philosopher, but also an intuitive critic. And I should probably get into a little bit of introduction here of George Santana, but at the same time I wanted to discuss his three philosophical poets, the essay he did on that, and it's rather lengthy, and I'm going to try to do it within the next within a couple of. See how this one goes, and do the other two poets two other shows. This one, in particular, the three philosophical poets, deals with Lucretius, Dante, and Goethe, but as he thought them, they're philosophical poets of great significance, and. I know their work quite well, and I feel that I thought this was quite a significant essay. I'm going to read a brief introduction on George Santana, not the entire, but just so we know. One second here, I'll get to the page. This introduction was written by Irving Singer, and the book that I'm reading from is probably out of print now. It's was edited by Irving Singer, and it's called The Essays in Literary Criticism of George Santayana, Let me just read this section. So, quick introduction here. I don't know if any of you know, but those of you who are probably tuning into this and are sure probably familiar with these works, but. Lucretius was always a rather. I always enjoyed his work. I was introduced to it at a rather young age. My studies, but really quite a fascinating poet, and so was. Of course, Dante's Inferno was the Inferno the. Paradiso and the Purgatorio, the Divine Comedies, were a remarkable read for me. They were transformative in so many ways. When I was seriously studying poetry and English poetry, comparative lit and so on, but. To go through life, I feel to go through life without being introduced to these poets is quite a shame. And I mean talking about billions and billions of people who aren't, and I feel in a way feel sad for them because these great, great works of literature can actually transform the mind, and I think that's basically what Santayana was saying, and I that's why he spent so much time and focus on these issues, because they were so very significant to the intellectual. pursuit of enlightenment and understanding, not only in a putting it not only in a historical perspective, but in a cosmic, universal, and metaphysical, of course, perspective. And of course, for those of you who might know Dante, of course, did the Divine Comedy, but Goethe was wrote Faust, and Faust, of course, was turned into a play. It was just a remarkable piece of work as well. And Faust was where the Dr. Faust sold his soul to the devil for the powers that were available that he was given to. And it says a lot about the human mind, the human soul, the human willingness to sell his soul to an entity he's not even certain that exists, for power. And I will get into that. But the first, I think it's important to take these as they were written, so that we can understand why they were written in this order. And I'm going to read a very brief introduction to George Santana. It's not really a brief introduction, but I'm going to read it briefly. Philosophers are not, and this is by Irving Singer, who edited this book. This book, by the way, I don't know if it's still in print. I should check on Amazon to see if they still have copies of it available. But this particular copyright is in 1956, and by Charles Scribner's and Son. And so we'll go on from there. Okay. Philosophers are not generally noted for their literary criticism. Just as literary critics have rarely distinguished themselves as philosophers. For all its integrity, the philosophic mind always runs the danger of becoming tendentious. It knows too much and cannot become as a little child. On the other hand, the literary mind all too often resembles the ghost of Hamlet's father. 'Tis here, 'tis there, a perturbed and insubstantial spirit that flits about and in mysterious darkness. It is a rare genius who can combine good philosophy and good literary criticism. George Santayana was a genius of this sort. One is even tempted to say that his genius was preeminently of this sort, and that in the special province of philosophical literary criticism, his contribution was more unique and more permanently outstanding than in any other field. In the last 200 years, there have been better philosophers and better essayists, and certainly better poets and novelists, but hardly any critics who have blended philosophical and literary insights with as free and authentic a hand as Santayana. Even among the greatest literary critics, there have been few who could do Santayana's job of work. Just what kind of work was it? The practice is almost lost among American writers. In the last 50 years, our philosophers and critics alike have become technical, minute, and pedagogical in a way that Santayana was never was. Ours is an age of instruments. We are devoted to examining the telescope, as Santayana would say, instead of looking through it. Santayana wanted to look. He was an intellectual astronomer with good eyesight and a refined sense of distance. Unlike recent critics, he was not particularly interested in the principles of rhetoric. For better or for worse, his criticism generally avoids both exegesis and linguistic analysis. He shows how the Homeric hymns, for instance, exemplify the imaginative function of religion, but he largely ignores the poetic devices they employ. He defines religion in terms of myth and metaphor, but he never attempts a thorough analysis of either myth or metaphor. Except for a few remarks about euphony and euphemism, euphemism, he has little to say about the rudiments of poetry. What excites the muse in him, and what makes his criticism so exciting, is rather an awareness of the human significance of literature, the way in which it can be used to communicate a sense of what is real and important. Santayana wished to treat literary works of art as expressions of an attitude toward the world which could be examined and criticized, not merely accepted or rejected. In this attempt, he tried to make his astronomical reports as comprehensive as possible. He filled them with philosophical commentary, reinforced by psychological insights, historical and biographical observations, and the expressions of his own moral and aesthetic taste. All of this contributes to a ricochet of ideas, a crossfire that is brilliant, even dazzling, so much so that the prose occasionally explodes in a burst of elegance, and one has difficulty separating the literary criticism from partisan maneuvering on the one hand and stylistic fireworks on the other. Comparison with Hegel is inevitable, and in the preface to The Life of Reason, which is an essay, Santayana reports that the first suggestions for the work came to him after reading, I can't pronounce this, unfortunately, it's in German. At the same time, however, Santayana claims that Hegel approached their common subject in history of human ideas with sophistry and romantic madness. A similar complaint could not be made against Santayana whenever or whatever his critical or philosophical faults may have been. He never thought that his astronomy discovered a universe governed by Germanic or other orderliness, and he never allowed his own perspective to cripple and cramp everything else in the name of universal will. There were marches in history, but no march of history. If anything, history was a series of aimless dances. One had to catch them individual rhythms. One had to use what Keats called negative capability, instead of forcing everything into the Hegelian three-step. All the same, there is one respect in which Santayana resembled Hegel. He had a definite point of view. Like Hegel, Santayana wrote within the framework of a personal philosophy that made up his telescope more than he may sometimes have admitted. In giving his excuse for writing about the three philosophical poets, Santayana says that they have revealed to me certain aspects of nature and of philosophy, which I am prompted by mere sincerity to express. But as we read on, we find that these aspects of nature and of philosophy turn out to be aspects within Santayana's own nature and philosophy. And the philosophical poets have not been chosen at random. They serve a definite philosophical purpose, however little they may be forced to subserve it. Santayana's intentions, clearly, was to choose in accordance with his personal and doctrinal needs, but then having chosen to report accurately and honestly what he saw. His criticism would then be a projection of himself without being a distortion of his subject matter. In reading Santayana's criticism as a projection of his own philosophy, we must always remember that the climate of his opinions altered as he grew older. In some ways, it became warmer, more tolerant, and less demanding. In other ways, colder, more remote, and detached from ordinary human interests. For instance, compare the poetry of barbarism with penitent art, which are two great essays that are in this book, which he wrote, Poetry of Barbarism, he wrote in 1900, and Penitent Art he wrote in 1922. In both essays, Santayana is describing what he considers to be significant but inferior art, the work of strangely misguided genius. But where the earlier essay almost sounds like a charge of the Light Brigade against the dark and irrational forces of Whitman's sensationalism and Browning's activism, the latter essay is a melancholy sigh, a gentle shaking of the deploring head, as if Santayana had come to see that it was only fitting for the tragic 20th century to express itself in an abstract, incomplete, and self-caricaturing manner. And I'm going to leave it at that because it goes into all of the other essays in the book. But I think I'm going to start with this. And like I said, the introduction is rather lengthy, and if you're going to read the book, it's great to do that. But I think just to get into the just so you understand the gist of why he wrote these essays and what he was contemplating, we will begin to understand. And I'm going to start with the introduction, Santayana's introduction to these poems. The three philosophical poets. The sole advantage in possessing great works of literature lies in what they can help us to become. I love this opening because it's so true. In themselves, as feats performed by their authors, they would have forfeited none of their truth or greatness if they had perished before our day. We can neither take away nor add to their past value or inherent dignity. It is only they, insofar as they are appropriate food and not poison for us, that can add to the present value and dignity of our minds. Foreign classics have to be retranslated and reinterpreted for each generation to render their old naturalness in a natural way and keep their perennial humanity living and capable of assimilation. Even native classics have to be reapprehended by every reader. It is this continual digestion of the substance supplied by the past that alone renders the insights of the past still potent in the present and for the future. Living criticism, genuine appreciation, is the interest we draw from year to year on the unrecoverable capital of human genius. Regarded from this point of view as substances to be digested, the poetic remains of Lucretius, Dante, and Goethe, though it is his Faust only that I shall speak of, afford rather a varied feast. In their doctrine and genius, they may seem to be too much opposed to be at all convergent of combinable or combinable in their wisdom. Some who know and care for one, perhaps, of these poets may be disposed to doubt whether they have anything vital to learn from the other two. Yet it is as a pupil, I hope a discriminating pupil of each in turn, that I mean to speak. And I venture to maintain that in what makes them great, they are compatible, that without any vagueness or doubleness in one's criterion of taste, one may acquire enthusiastically the poetry of each in turn, and that one may accept the essential philosophy, the positive intuition of each, without lack of definition or system in one's own thinking. And I think that's the way it is in everything that we talk about, everything that we learn. You know, we learn what we're most attracted to learning, and we understand that, and we whatever. Emerson once said, and I quoted that, whatever we are meant to hear, we will hear. Whatever we are meant to read, we'll read. It comes to us in long and winding passages, he says. I believe he's right. Indeed, the diversity of these three poets passes, if I may use the Hegelian dialect, into a unity of higher kind. Each is typical of an age. Taken together, they sum up all European philosophy. Lucretius adopted the most radical and most correct of those cosmological systems which the genius of early Greece had devised. He sees the world to be one great edifice, one great machine, all its parts reacting upon one another and growing out of one another in obedience to a general pervasive process of life. His poem describes the nature, that is, the birth and composition of all things. It shows how they are compounded out of elements and how these elements, which he thinks are atoms in perpetual motion, are being constantly redistributed, so that old things perish and new things arise. Into the view of the world, he fits a view of human life as it ought to be led under such conditions. His materialism is completed by an aspiration towards freedom and quietness of spirit. Allowed to look once upon the wonderful spectacle, which is to repeat itself in the world forever, we should look and admire, for tomorrow we die. We should eat, drink, and be merry, but moderately and with much art, lest we die miserably and die today. This is one complete system of philosophy, materialism in natural science, humanism in ethics. Such was the gist of all Greek philosophy before Socrates, of that philosophy which was truly Hellenic, and corresponded with the movement which produced Greek manners, Greek government, and Greek art, a movement towards simplicity, autonomy, and reasonableness in everything from dress to religion. Such is the gist also of what may be called the philosophy of the Renaissance, the reassertion of science and liberty in the modern world by Bacon, by Spinoza, by the whole contemporary school that looks to science for its view of the facts, and to the happiness of men on earth for its ideal. This system is called naturalism, and of this Lucretius is the unrivaled poet. Skip 1,000 years or more, and a contrasting spectacle is before us. All minds, all intuitions are dominated by a religion that represents the soul as a pilgrim upon earth. The world is fallen and subject to the devil. Pain and poverty are considered normal. Happiness is impossible here, and to be hoped for only in a future life. Provided the snares and pleasures of the present life have not entrapped us. Meantime, a sort of Jacob's ladder stretches from the stone on which the wayfarer lays his head into the heaven he hopes for. And the angels he sees ascending and descending upon it are beautiful stories, wonderful theories, and comforting rites. Through these he partakes, even on earth, of what will be his heavenly existence. He partly understands his destiny, his own history, his own history, and that of the world are transfigured before him, and without ceasing to be sad, become beautiful. The raptures of a perfect conformity with the will of God and of union with him overtake him in his prayers. This is supernaturalism, a system represented in Christendom chiefly by the Catholic Church, but adopted also by the later pagans and widespread in Asia from remote antiquity down to the present time. Little as the momentary temper of Europe and America may now incline to such a view, it is always possible for the individual or for the race to return to it. Its sources are in the solitude of the spirit and the disparity or the opposition between what the spirit feels it is fitted to do and what in this world it is condemned to waste itself upon. The unmatched poet of this supernaturalism is Dante. That's for real. You know, most people recognize his work with the Inferno, you know, of the Inferno. But so few people, so few people recognize the Paradiso or the Purgatorio, which is his Dante's the Inferno is the ascent into hell, and the with the guide of Virgil, poet Virgil, was his guide, and when he wrote Purgatorio, it was purgatory, and he had the same guide in the Purgatorio and in the Inferno, but because Virgil was a pagan, he could not ascend into the Christian heaven, into the heaven that Dante was described in his work in the Paradiso. And the Paradiso is just one of the most remarkable works I've ever read, philosophical, metaphysical works that I've ever read, in the sense that it just, and by the way, his guide to that was his guide's name was Beatrice. And Beatrice was his cousin who passed away at a young age, and she was pure and innocent and so on. But she guided him into heaven, and into the different levels of heaven, and up until seeing the face of God. Remarkable man, imagination. Gift that he had, Dante, and I love that. I just love that work. And it was transformational. Of course, Dante was exiled from Italy, because he depicted all the popes in hell, and it was quite the rouse, I'm getting off the subject, but we'll get into that as we get into Dante, Santayana's wonderful criticism of Dante. But let us continue with Lucretius, or with the introduction. I'm hoping I have a chance to read some of his work on Lucretius. We're almost at the end here of his This is one complete system of philosophy. Materialism is a natural science, humanism in ethics. Such is the gist of all Greek philosophy before Socrates. Of that philosophy, I just read this, I believe, excuse me for losing my place here. We're talking about Jacob's ladder stretching from the stone. Wayfarer lays his head into the heavens he hopes for, and the angels see. He sees ascending and descending upon it our beautiful stories, wonderful theories, and comforting rites. Though these he partakes even on earth of what will be his heavenly existence, he partly understands his destiny, his own history, and that of the world as transfigured before him, and without ceasing to be sad, become beautiful. The raptures of a perfect conformity and with the will of God and of union with him overtake him in his prayers. Again, this is supernaturalism, a system represented in Christendom chiefly by the Catholic Church, but adopted also by the later pagans widespread in Asia from the remote antiquity down to the recent present time. Little as the momentary temper of Europe and America may now incline to such a view, it is always possible for the individual or for the race to return to it. I know I'm repeating this, but I apologize. Its sources are in the solitude of the spirit and disparity. Or the opposition between what the spirit feels it to be fitted to and what in this world it is condemned to waste itself upon. And the unmatched poet of this supernaturalism is Dante. And skip again some 500 years, and there is another change of scene. The Teutonic races that had previously conquered Europe have begun to dominate and understand themselves. They have become Protestants or protesters against the Roman world. An infinite fountain of life seems to be unlocked within their bosom. They turn successively to the Bible to learn, to patriotism, to industry, and for new objects to love and fresh worlds to conquer. But they have too much vitality and too little maturity to rest in any of these things. A demon drives them on, and this demon, divine and immortal in its apparent waywardness, is their inmost self. This is the German, the Teutonic race. It is their insatiable will, their radical courage. Nay, though this be a hard saying to the uninitiated, their will is the creator of all those objects by which it is sometimes abused and sometimes baffled, but never tamed. There will summons all opportunities and dangers out of nothing to feed its appetite for action. And in that ideal function lies their sole reality. And once attained, things are transcended. Like the episodes of a spent dream, they are to be smiled at and forgotten. The spirit that feigned and discarded them remains always strong and undefiled. It aches for new conquests over new fictions. Now, again, I should mention this, as he's writing this, he actually wrote this before World War I, right? I believe he wrote this in 1900, this particular essay on the philosophical poets. So in 1900, of course, there was no, but he sure understood the German mindset that would later lead to World War II and World War I. Like the episodes of Spent Dream, they are to be smiled at and forgotten. The spirit that feigned and discarded them remains always strong and undefiled. It aches for new conquests over new fictions. This is romanticism. It is an attitude often found in English poetry and characteristic of German philosophy. It was adopted by Emerson and ought to be sympathetic to Americans, for it expresses the self-trust of world-building youth and the mystical faith in will and action. And the greatest monument to this romanticism is Goethe's Faust. Can it be an ancient, or can it be an accident that the most adequate and probably the most lasting exposition of these three schools of philosophy should have been made by poets? Are poets at heart in search of a philosophy, or is philosophy in the end nothing but poetry? Let us consider the situation. If we think of philosophy as an investigation into truth, or as reasoning upon truths supposed to be discovered, there is nothing in philosophy akin to poetry. There is nothing poetic about the works of Epicurus or St. Thomas Aquinas or Kant. They are leafless forests. In Lucretius and in Dante themselves, we find passages where nothing is poetical except the meter, or some incidental ornament. In such passages, the form of poetry is thrown over the substance of prose, as Lucretius himself confesses, where he says, "As when physicians would contrive to administer loathsome wormwood to little boys, they first moisten the rim of the cup round about the sweet and with sweet and golden honey. Whether children, unsuspecting youth, may be beguiled to the lips, but no further, while they drink down the bitter poison, by deception, not betrayed, but rather by that stratagem made whole and restored. So I have willed to set forth our doctrine before thee in sweet-sounding Parian song, and to smear it, as it were, with the muse's honey." This is Lucretius stating how he wrote. Okay. "But poetry cannot be spread upon things like butter. It must play upon them like light, and be the medium through which we see them." And Lucretius does himself an injustice. If his philosophy had been wormwood to him, he could not have said, as he does just before this passage, "Like a sharp blow of the thyrsus, a great hope of praise vibrates through my heart and fills my breast with tender love of the muses, whereby now, instinct with flowering fancy, I traverse pathless haunts of the parodies by no man's foot trodden before. It is joy to reach undefiled fountains and quaff. It is a joy to gather fresh flowers and weave a matchless crown for my head of those bays in which never yet the muses veiled the brow of any man. First, in that I teach sublime truths and come to free the soul from the strangling knots of superstition. Then, in that on so dark a theme I pour forth so clear a song, suffusing all with poetic beauty. If haply by such means I might keep my mind intent upon my verses until thine eye fathoms the whole structure of nature and the fixed form that makes it beautiful." Here I think we have a solution to our doubt. The reasonings and investigations of philosophy are arduous, and if poetry is to be linked with them, it can be artificially only, and with a bad grace. But the vision of philosophy is sublime. The order it reveals in the world is something beautiful, tragic, sympathetic to the mind, and just what every poet, on a small or on a large scale, is always trying to catch. In philosophy itself, investigation and reasoning are only preparatory and servile parts, means to an end. They terminate in insight, or what in the noblest sense of the word may be called theory, a steady contemplation of all things in their order and worth. Such contemplation is imaginative. No one can reach it who has not enlarged his mind and tamed his heart. A philosopher who attains it is, for the moment, a poet, and a poet who turns his practice and passionate imagination on the order of all things, or on anything in the light of the whole, is for that moment a philosopher. Nevertheless, even if we grant that the philosopher in his best moments is a poet, we may suspect that the poet has his worst moments when he tries to be a philosopher, or rather when he succeeds at being one. Oh man, is that true? And philosophy is something reasoned and heavy. Poetry is something winged, flashing, inspired. Take almost any longish poem, and the parts of it are better than the whole. A poet is able to put together a few words, a cadence or two, a single interesting image. He renders it that way, some moment of a comparatively high tension, of comparatively keen sentiment. But at the next moment, the tension is relaxed, sentiment has faded, and what succeeds is usually incongruous with what went before, or at least inferior. And the thought drifts away from it, or rather, the thought drifts away from what it has started to be. It is lost in the sands of versification. As man is now constituted, to be brief is almost a condition of being inspired. Man, that's so true. If anybody writes poetry out there or has written poems, it's a flash. It's an inspiration. And I've, on my notes section, I created two rather long poems. One is called The Shadow Poems, and the other is Whitefields. And not exceedingly long, but, you know, long in the sense that they're, you know, longer than most poems. But this, what he's saying is so true about the about gaining that image and then continuing and trying to create the stanzas and the rhyme and the meter, of course, the cadence, but the keeping with the imagery, and that's why it's almost a poet must be, well, in my case anyway, I don't know if, you know, I'm sure it's in others, everyone who was a poet definitely was in Lucretius, definitely in Dante, and definitely in Lilith. And Donne and Keats and Shelley, and, oh my God, it's just on and on and on and on. But the every poet grabs a piece of some universal spirit that communicates through him. And that's the most exhilarating thing about poetry, is the exhilarating thing about writing it, and why the great ones, the greatest poets, have just been able to ride that wave of inspiration. And, you know, many of them have been... Unfortunately, they're prone to drugs and drinking and unusual endorphin-provoking or promoting habits. But we're, you know, but in the overall, it somehow it creates the work. It allows poets to. And writers and artists and musicians to achieve a level a fourth dimensional or fifth dimensional state mind that just allows that information or that image or that music or, you know, to flow through them. And the closer they connect to their heart, the closer they connect to their soul, the greater that image is, and the greater is their work. I'm kind of getting away from myself here, and I wanted to, we got about 15 or 20 minutes left of the show. Shall we say then that I now broach an idea by which I set some store, that poetry is essentially a short-winded, essentially short-winded, that what is poetic is necessarily intermittent in the writing of poets. What only is a fleeting moment, the mood, the episode, can be rapturously felt or rapturously rendered, while life as a whole, history, character, and destiny, are objects unfit for imagination to dwell on and repellent to poetic art. I cannot think so. If it be a fact that it often is, that we find little things pleasing and great things arid and formless, and if we are better poets in a line than in an epic, that is simply due to the lack of faculty on our part. lack of imagination and memory, and above all, lack of discipline. This might be shown, I think, by psychological analysis, if we care to rely on something so abstract and so debatable. For in what does the short-winded poet himself excel? The common, unimaginative person who talks or who stares? Is it that he thinks even less? Rather, I suppose, in that he feels more, in that his moment of intuition, through fleeting, though fleeting, has a vision, a scope, a symbolic something about it that renders it deep and expressive. Intensity, even momentary intensity, if can be expressed at all, comports fullness, and suggestion compresses into the intense moment. Yes, everything that comes to us at all must come to us at some time or other. It is always the fleeting moment in which we live. To this fleeting moment, the philosopher, as well as the poet, is actually confined. Each must enrich it with his endless vistas, vistas necessarily focused, if they are to be disclosed at all, in the eyes of the observer here and now. But what makes the difference between a moment of a poetic insight and a vulgar moment is that the passions of the poet's moment, the poetic moment, have more perspective. Even the short-winded poet selects his words so that they have a magic momentum in them which carries us, we know not how, to mountaintops of intuition. Is not the poetic quality of phrases and images due to their concentrating and liberating the confused promptings left in us by a long experience? When we feel the poetic thrill, is it not that we find sweep in the concise and depth in the clear as we find in the light of the sea and the water of a jewel? And what is a philosophic thought but such an epitome? If a short passage is poetical, it is pregnant with suggestion of a few things, which stretches our attention and makes us rapt and serious. How much more poetical ought a vision to be, which was pregnant with all we care for? Focus a little experience. Give some scope and depth to your feeling, and it grows imaginative. Give it more scope and more depth. Focus all experience within it. Make it a philosopher's vision of the world, and it will grow imaginative in a superlative degree and be supremely poetical. The difficulty after having the experience to symbolize lies only in having enough imagination to hold and suspend it in a thought, and further to give it this thought such verbal expression that others may be able to decipher it and to be stirred by it as by a wind of suggestion sweeping the whole forest of their memories. Poetry, then, is not poetical for being short-winded or incidental, but on the contrary, for being comprehensive and having range. It too must matter, if too much matter renders it heavy. That is the fault of the poet's weak intellect, not of the outstretched world. A quicker eye, a more synthetic imagination, might grasp a larger subject with the same ease. The picture that would render this larger subject would not be flatter and feebler for its extent. But on the contrary, deeper and stronger, since it would possess as much unity as the little one with greater volume. As in a supreme dramatic crisis, all our life seems to be focused in the present and used in coloring our consciousness and shaping our decisions. So for each philosophical poet or philosophic poet, the whole world of man is gathered together, and he is never so much a poet as when, in a single cry, he summons all that has affinity to him in the universe and salutes his ultimate destiny. It is the acme of life to understand life. The height of poetry is to speak the language of the gods. Man, if that doesn't knock you dead, I don't know what does, because that's a pure understanding of poetry and a pure appreciation of it in the highest sense. And that's why George Santana, Santayana was just a brilliant mind that could get grasp not only the heart but the intellect at the same time, fuse them together through philosophy and through poetry, and that's why his works, I believe, should be preserved forever. And why I wish to honor him tonight by reading this great essay. And I hope I can do it justice. But I wanted to spend the next three Thursday nights on this particular works, because I believe that they're so important to those, and so many people out there probably have never heard of neither heard of George Santayana, nor have they heard of Lucretius. Possibly they've heard of Dante and Goethe, but I'm sure they've never heard this criticism or praise or concise selections of their works as they are in this book, unless they've read this book. In the next few minutes I have, I'm going to start on the section of Lucretius, and we will continue this next week, the Lucretius, because it's rather a long section. And the following week we'll get into Dante, and then the following week after that we will get into Goethe, and finish this essay on three philosophical poets. Let me go to part two, which is Lucretius. We are told of the old Xenophanes that he looked up into the round heaven and cried, "The all is one." What is logically a truism may also be imaginatively a great discovery, because no one before may have thought of the obvious analogy which the truism registers. So in this case, the unity of all things is logically and evident, if barren truth, for the most desperate and unrelated worlds would still be a multitude, and so an aggregate, and so in some sense a unity. Yet it was a great imaginative feat to cast the eye deliberately round the entire horizon to draw mentally the sum of all reality, discovering that reality makes such a sum and may be called one, as any stone or animal, though composed of many parts, is yet called one in common parlance. It was doubtless some prehistoric man of genius, long before Xenophanes was first applied in this way to all things together, that notion of unity and wholeness which everybody had gained by observation of things singly, and who first ventured to speak of the world. To do so is to set the problem for all natural philosophy, and in a certain measure to anticipate the solution of that problem, for it is to ask how things hang together and to assume that they do hang together in one way or another. This is so Emersonian. I mean, you can see where Emersonian's philosophy, I've written, those of you who might have followed, maybe following my series here, I've done a number of essays, read a number of essays by Emerson. And his essays so much play into this naturalism, into this spirit of oneness, this oversoul, this Lucretian philosophy. Let me continue. To cry, the all is one, and to perceive that all things are in one landscape and form a system by their juxtaposition is the real beginning of wisdom in natural philosophy. But it is easy to go farther and to see that things form a unity in a far deeper and more mysterious way. One of the first things, for instance, that impresses the poet, the man of feeling and reflection, is that these objects, that people, the world, all pass away, and that the place thereof knows them no more. Yet when they vanish, nothing does not succeed. Other things rise in their stead. Nature remains always young and whole in spite of death at work everywhere, and that takes the place of what continually disappears is often remarkably like it in character. Excuse me. Universal instability is not incompatible with a great monotony in things, so that while Heraclitus lamented that everything was in flux. Ecclesiastes, who was also entirely convinced of the truth, could lament that there was nothing new under the sun. This double experience of mutation and recurrence, an experience at once sentimental and scientific, soon brought with it a very great thought, perhaps the greatest thought that mankind has ever hit upon, and which was the chief inspiration of Lucretius. It is that all we observe about us, and ourselves also, may be so many passing forms of a permanent substance. This substance, while remaining the same in quantity and in inward quality, is constantly redistributed. In its redistribution, the forms those aggregates which we call things, and which we find constantly disappearing and reappearing. All things are dust, and to dust they return, a dust, however, eternally fertile and destined to fall perpetually into new and beltless beautiful forms. We're talking quantum physics here, fractal consciousness here. We're talking philosophy, poetry, reaching the understanding of science, or science reaching the understanding of philosophy and poetry. The notion of substance lends a much greater unity to the outspread world. It persuades us that all things pass into one another and have a common ground from which they spring successively and to which they return. The spectacle of inexorable change, the triumph of time, or whatever we may call it, has always been a favorite theme or lyric in tragic poetry. And for religious meditation, our time is up here, but I'm going to continue this paragraph and possibly just a little more, and we'll close for the evening. I'm going to also continue this. I want to continue this discussion on Lucretius and naturalism and so on into next week's show. So we'll probably take up that entire program until we get to the works of Dante. My intention is to do this entire essay in its entirety, if possible. I lost my space here. Right. Hey, there's nothing new under the sun. This double experience of mutation and reoccurrence in experience of one sentimental and scientific soon brought with it a fiery great thought. I said, probably perhaps the greatest thought that man ever conceived. Again, I'm going to repeat this little section here, but the spectacle of inexorable change, the triumph of time, or whatever we may call it, has always been a favorite theme for lyric and tragic poetry and for religious meditation. To perceive universal mutation, to feel the vanity of life, has always been the beginning of seriousness. It is the condition for any beautiful, measured, or tender philosophy. Prior to that, everything is barbarous, both in morals and in poetry. For until then, mankind has not learned to renounce anything, has not outgrown the instinctive egotism and optimism of the youth, or rather of the young animal, and has not removed the center of its being or of its faith from the will to the imagination. To discover substance, then, is a great step in the life of reason, even if substance be conceived quite negatively as a term that serves merely to mark, by contrast, the unsubstantiality, the vanity of all particular moments and things. That is the way in which Indian poetry and philosophy conceived substance. But the step taken by Greek physics and by the poetry of Lucretius passes beyond. Lucretius and the Greeks, in observing universal mutation and the vanity of life, conceived behind appearance a great intelligible process, an evolution in nature. The reality became interesting as well as the illusion. And physics became scientific, which had previously been merely spectacular. Here was a much richer theme for the poet and the philosopher. It was launched upon the discovery of the ground and secret causes of this gay and melancholy flux. The understanding that enabled him to discover these causes did for the European what no Indian mystic, what no despiser of understanding anywhere, suffers himself to do, namely to dominate, foretell, and transform his changing flow with a virile, practical intelligence. The man who discovers the secret springs of appearances opens to contemplation a second positive world, the workshop and busy depths of nature, where a prodigious mechanism is continually supporting our life and making ready for it from afar by the most exquisite adjustments. The march of this mechanism, which it produces life and often fosters it, yet as often makes it difficult and condemns it to extinction. This truth, which the conception of natural substance first makes intelligible, justifies the elegies which the poet of illusion and disillusion have always written upon human things. It is a truth with a melancholy side, but being a truth, it satisfies and exalts the rational mind that craves truth as truth, whether it be sad or comforting, and wishes to pursue us a possible, not an impossible, happiness. Thus the pursuit of happiness and the pursuit of truth. It's so important for us to understand the origins of our society based on the philosophies that were prevalent during the time. Of course, Lucretius was well known by our founding fathers. Lucretius was extremely well known, as well as were the epic poems, Homer and Virgil and the Aeneid and the Odyssey and the Iliad and these great Greek poems and plays were all known at that time and read by scholars, but more so the works of the mystics, the works of the great thinkers were a part of these esoteric schools, these schools of thought, these schools of mystics, these schools of the Masons, if you will, or the other, many other different um, schools. And I think once, and I'm hoping, and maybe the thrust of tonight, of this three or four programs in the series of George Santayana's philosophical poets, I'm hoping will educate and enlighten those listening upon the, and possibly they can gain an understanding, a better understanding of the greater poets, of American poets, Emerson, Whitman. He talks about Whitman in here. He talks about the poetry of barbarism and early American poetry, and how it so differs from the classical poets in so many ways, and yet it in itself has its own truth and its own beauty and its own remarkable voice, until you get now to the 21st century, and poets today have the wealth of experience that before them, wealth of knowledge and traditions and so on that they can, and vehicles to pursue these remarkable works. And I praise anyone who is a poet, whether they're brilliant or whether they're mediocre or whether they're poor. It doesn't really matter, because not because to the poet, I've known many poets in my life. I've had many friends who are poets. And to the poet, it's not so much the fame or the fortune or the prominence or whatever it is. It's for the moment. It's for being in the present moment that is so rewarding, to be able to capture in verse or in words the emotion that you're experiencing at that moment, or the vision that you're having of some specific thing that may, you know, if you're writing an epic poem or whatever it may be. But these are the things that we as poets, this is our food, you know, this is what we eat and drink and exist upon and write, because it's definitely not money. You know, I don't know any poet that's really made a living writing poems, even the great ones. So the existence say, we express ourselves, we express ourselves. And that's probably the greatest thing to be able to do, is to express yourself. And if somebody can, if you can express it to someone else, and someone else grabs it and goes, wow, that was good, I really caught that, then what you've done is you've created a pure communication with another individual. And that is what poetry does. That's what writing does. But poetry in itself, and the beauty of the spoken word, the spoken poem, is just a remarkable thing. Or the performance poet. I've seen so many wonderful performance poets that can just knock you out, And, but those who can do that have grasped the basic fundamentals of merging the philosophical with the poetic. And by doing so, have created that perfect vehicle of word, sound, meter, and divine inspiration, and allowing that to communicate to another individual, which is, one of the best things you can do. And person can click, be inspired, or understand a major moment or a major issue or a major concept, all right? And it would enlighten them and excel them into a higher dimensional train of thought, you know, and from there they'll never be the same. It's like reading, like I said, after reading Dante's Divine Comedy, it's like, oh my God, you know, I never read anything so remarkable. I gotta say, Milton's Paradise Lost was just blew me away. In fact, I took an entire college course just on Milton's Paradise, Milton. And we studied the Paradise Lost. One of the most remarkable courses I'd ever taken. And very, very good, brilliant professor that I had. This is many years ago now. But over 20 years ago or more. But nevertheless, I just wanted to, before I go on this, I know I'm way past the hour here and I'm dragging it on, but I want you to join me to next Thursday when I take the second, when our second show on this topic, and we'll discuss further the works of Lucretius. And the criticism of George Santayana. And so join me then. And okay, and join me on Wednesday when we discuss our regular news and interviews and so on. But Thursday, our philosophical, metaphysical program, and on Friday night, next Friday. This Friday, we will not be talking with George, but we will not be on, but next Friday night we will be having George Dixon with us again. And so I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight and wish you a pleasant weekend.